Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another edition of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston. And has anything happened since the last time we talked about 2 weeks ago? Yeah, no. I think we've had some things happen over the past 2 weeks. And I think one of them is that we're on day 14 of Will Joe Biden drop out of the race coverage? Now, it does appear that some of Michigan's Democratic congressional members are remaining on President Biden's side after, let's be honest, his disastrous debate 2 weeks ago. Good friend of the podcast, John King from Michigan Advance reports that Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Senator Debbie Stabenow, and Congresswoman Haley Stevens have publicly said that they continue to back Biden. However, State Representative Phil Skaggs of East Grand Rapids released a statement on his social media begging Biden to pass the torch to a new generation of Democrats if we hope to defeat Trump and his Christo-fascist brigade. Former State Democratic Party Chair Lonnie Johnson also called for President Biden to step aside. A friend of the podcast, State Representative Jason Morgan, meanwhile, told Michigan Advance that while Trump was absolutely awful during that debate as well, and he was, it's up to Biden to decide if he wants to remain in the race. Not exactly a ringing endorsement, really. Former Congressman David Bonnier talked about Biden's struggles in that debate and declared it a technical knockout, a TKO, as he expressed his desire for Biden to hand the torch over to Vice President Kamala Harris. Attorney General Dana Nessel used a more indirect approach, I think, when she released a tweet over the weekend describing her support for U.S. women's soccer legend Alex Morgan's decision to not be part of this year's Olympic team, saying, and I'm quoting here from A.G. Nessel, "I adore Alex Morgan, one of the greatest of all time, but she's aged significantly from her prime playing days and gracefully accepted that in order to win the gold, it was time to pass the baton." Something tells me that the A.G. is talking about someone else than Alex Morgan. Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate, Hill Harper, says no matter what Biden does, the party will have to come together fast or else face electoral disaster. I agree with that, but Harper still isn't signaling either way what he wants to happen. His opponent, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin, has been mostly silent on this issue. I thought it was because she was seeing some of the polling or maybe waiting for some extra polling before making a statement. However, as of this recording, Alyssa Slotkin has chimed in with some comments, and this is from the New York Times, and I'm quoting. She said, "Right now, President Biden is behind Trump in all of our polling." The New York Times says she told donors she was running for the seat only because Senator Debbie Stabenow, age 74, was doing a radical thing and passing the torch. Wow. Now that is a significant development there. And it makes sense because something has to happen here real soon since Republican frontrunner Florida Mike Rogers isn't all that far behind Slotkin in the polling. In the last poll from the most recent reliable Epic MRA that was back on June 30th, it showed that Slotkin has a scant 2% lead over Rogers, 2%. That same poll showed Trump with a 5-point lead over Biden. A 5-point lead over Biden in Michigan, everyone. And that poll was taken before the debate. Now, before some of you discount the poll, remember that Epic MRA's final poll of the 2022 gubernatorial race between Whitmer and Republican Tudor Dixon had Whitmer with an 11-point lead, and Whitmer ended up winning her re-election by 11%. So Epic MRA nailed it there. Nailed it. Now, what happened in 2020 when Biden took on Trump in Michigan? Well, Epic MRA's final poll heading into that election had Biden holding a 7-point lead over Trump in Michigan. But as we know, Biden ended up only winning Michigan by 3 percentage points. So Epic MRA underestimated Trump's strength in the state. Trump so far leading Biden by 5 points here. And again, those numbers came out before the debate. Look, it's been an exhausting last 14 days for Democrats, for progressives, and for independents. Everyone has been arguing back and forth and many times arguing past each other on what is exactly the best course of action to take. This is some new territory. It's historical territory. I gave my viewpoint on YouTube the day after the election, and my opinion still holds that I think that Biden should step aside. But listen, I respect everyone who has differing opinions on this subject. Again, we are in new territory. I understand the arguments saying that everyone must just stick with Joe and that it really could be taking a hell of a chance. All right, that we could really be taking a hell of a chance to usher in a new person, whether it be VP Harris or someone else like Governor Whitmer. I get that. I get it completely. I've heard some echo the sentiments that we can't relive another Chicago 1968 convention, which eventually led to the election of Richard Nixon. But while this year's Democratic convention is also happening in Chicago, I think we're taking the wrong conclusions of that convention. First of all, President Johnson stepped aside because his polling numbers inside the party weren't the best due to the Vietnam War, and he got out back in March of 68. Second, and this one I truly believe, but I have to admit, we'll never exactly know for sure, but I truly believe had Bobby Kennedy made it to Chicago, he would have been the nominee. And I think it's safe to say he would have destroyed Nixon. I mean, he definitely would have been able to energize the ticket, the Democratic ticket, completely, more than Hubert Humphrey turned out to be able to do. We can't discount the demoralization that Bobby Kennedy's assassination had on so many people, people who put their hopes on him to end the war. I mean, everything unraveled in ways in Chicago in 68 that no one could anticipate for the Democratic Party. But this time it's different. This time, people are so afraid of another Trump term that they are in need of someone showing that they are ready to not just fight against Trump and the extremism and the elite corruption that he represents, but they are needing somebody to demonstrate how they are fighting for them on a daily basis from now until Election Day. That debate shook everyone up, and rightly so. They saw the polling, but they believed, and I have to admit, I think I was one of them still holding out hope that, as he did in the State of the Union back in March, I hope that Biden would relieve some of the worries that many of us had about his age and his ability to take it to Trump. But he didn't do it. He couldn't do it. And you can't blame people for freaking out. You can't blame people for freaking out and for wanting an alternative or calling for an alternative. And I don't think telling everyone to love it or leave it, you know, to use the saying many on the right yelled at anti-Vietnam protesters of the 60s, I don't think that's a winning strategy either. Look, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't. And if Biden ultimately decides to stay in the race, okay, then that's what we have to go with. I've given my piece. And I hope for a change at the top of the ticket. I really, really do. But if he doesn't step down, then I hope I'm disastrously wrong about everything. I do. And I hope many of you on election night or the day after the election will come at me and say, Pat, you were wrong. We were right. Hey, I hope you guys prove me wrong. And I hope Joe proves me wrong. My podcast, though, is most concerned about what's happening here in Michigan. And I'm going to try to fight to keep Michigan's legislature blue. And I'll keep pushing that message from now until Election Day, because as much as we are focusing on what's happening at the presidential level, and it is indeed important, as I'm going to talk about here in a second, we have to keep the state legislature blue. We have to keep the state house blue. because I believe Michigan is truly providing a blueprint for all Democrats to follow across the country. In fact, if the Biden team and Democrats really wanted to control the media narrative and at least divert the frenzy around Biden's age and health, I wish they'd use Governor Whitmer, who's part of his reelection team. I wish they'd use her to show how Michigan Democrats are passing policies proving that we are truly the anti-Florida. I mean, why not use her? Why not use her to talk about all the pro-worker, pro-family, pro-union, pro-women's health, pro-environment, pro-clean energy movement, pro-LGBTQ plus rights, pro-freedom, pro-children, and true pro-life policies that they've passed here since Democrats took control of the state trifecta? Why not have Whitmer hammer that message home every day and use Michigan as the example for the entire country? I noticed that the Biden-Harris campaign released a tweet asking everyone this week to look up Project 2025. And I guess that's a good idea, although, you know, it probably would have been a more effective strategy to have brought that up and hung it around Trump's neck during the debate. Keep calm, Pat. Keep calm. Anyway, I brought up Project 2025 a few times here on the podcast, and it's a policy blueprint created by the fascist right-wing Heritage Foundation in case Trump gets back into the White House. It's a corporate Christian nationalist takeover of our government, and it's all right there in the 992-page outline. Bridge Magazine this week has a good story on it saying the policy agenda of Project 2025 includes plans to crack down on contraceptives and mail order abortion medication, eliminate a federally funded preschool program for low-income students, scale back non-discrimination protections for gay and transgender residents, and begin mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. Hey, everybody's complaining about inflation at the grocery stores. Enjoy higher vegetable and fruit costs. But it also wants to eliminate the administrative state, especially the Environmental Protection Agency, because profits are more important than the health of the people and the places where they live. Remember, this is from the so-called pro-life crowd. Oh, and this screed was also put together by some of the nut jobs coming from Hillsdale College here in Michigan. So even though we passed abortion rights here in the state, Project 2025, for example, calls for the reinstatement of the Comstock Act, an 1870s law that bans the distribution of abortion medication. And you know the Supreme Court will back it. That's just one goodie that's in there right now. It would also, here's some more, it would also erase federal programs for low-income Americans like Head Start, which means some 30,000 preschool kids in Michigan would be left with nothing. Again, another one of those pro-life policies. Hooray! But here's something else. Here's something else. Project 2025 would eliminate free breakfasts and lunches for all students at all public schools. Why? Because those are popular programs, everyone. They're popular with parents. And as we've seen how successful that program here is in the state, Democrats, along with a little bit of Republican support this time around, passed an extension of the free meals at public schools program. You see, if they're popular, that means it's harder for right-wingers to pass school voucher laws, which diverts money from public schools to for-profit charter schools. That's always been their goal. That is why they are against free meals for all public school students. So if Trump gets in office, free meals for students, gone. And there's nothing we can do about it. Also, Project 2025 wants to attack and eliminate Obamacare and hurt Medicare and Medicaid. We already heard Republicans in Congress say that they want to go after Social Security and privatize it again. I mean, this is what a Donald Trump victory means. And this is what former Governor Rick Snyder wants, as he's currently raising cash to put MAGA Republicans back into power in the state house. You see, the state house is up for grabs this year, everyone. And if MAGA Republicans get the gavel, buckle up. Nothing will get done here. They'll block common sense progressive policies from ever reaching Governor Whitmer's desk due to their bat crap insane beliefs. For example, just this week, Governor Whitmer signed a bill into law introduced by another friend of the podcast, State Representative Ranjiv Puri, that from now on prevents homeowners association agreements from blocking homeowners from making energy saving updates on their homes, like installing solar panels. So, like Michigan Democrats did when they passed a law allowing farmers the freedom to use their own land for large clean energy projects like solar and wind farms, Democrats believe people should have the freedom to save on energy costs while helping the environment at the same time. Everyone, that's called common sense. Everyone, that is called freedom. And that's what MAGA Republicans and their precious Project 2025 want to take away from you. They want to take away your freedom. Why do you think Trump is distancing himself from Project 2025? Why? Because it's fascism on steroids. But as much as he wants to say he didn't know anything about it, it sure seems like he's surrounded by supporters who helped write it. I mean, that's how you change the narrative. That's how you play offense. Hang a Project 2025 like an anvil around his neck. Play offense, Democrats, like Michigan Democrats have been doing for the past 2 years. Follow their example. See, everyone is reacting to their agenda, to what the Democrats in the state here have done, and they are reacting to the policies they passed, most of them good, sound, progressive policies. They are driving the narrative. Republicans always have to react to everything that Democrats here in the state are doing. Democrats in Michigan are driving the narrative. And is it any wonder why Whitmer enjoys strong polling numbers in the state? Democrats are driving the narrative because they are passing policies that are popular with the people. One of those strong, sensible progressives in the state legislature is Democratic State Representative Carrie Reingans of Ann Arbor. Her district contains both cities and rural areas, and she's been able to get a good handle on what binds people together, what brings people together, what are some of the common interests. And she uses all that information, and she uses all of her expertise and her experiences in her district to help as many families as possible so that they can do well for both themselves and their kids. She's standing by here to talk about her work on affordable housing, affordable healthcare, on expanding democracy across the country and trying to get Michigan to join the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Representative Carrie Reingans is coming up right after this. You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
It's awesome to bring back Democratic Michigan State Representative Carrie Reingans back on the podcast this week. Representative Reingans is from the 47th House District, which contains parts of Ann Arbor and Washtenaw County, and I believe out to the eastern parts of Jackson County. She's a strong progressive fighter in Lansing, focusing on so many things like affordable housing, healthcare for all, lower drug prices, voting rights, and pushing Michigan to become part of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And she's fighting to help just keep Michigan blue this November so that MAGA Republicans cannot stifle the strides that we've been able to make here in our state over the last 18 months. So Representative Reingans, thank you so very much for coming back here on Left of Lansing. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much for having me back on.
Hey, if you don't mind, I'd like to first ask you about your district because your district contains both cities and rural areas. What do you think are some of the similarities that you've learned through the years between voters who live in more populated areas and those who live in less populated areas in your district? I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you grew up in a rural area of Michigan, and I've got to believe that that experience really helps you connect with so many people, you know, in a diverse area of your district.
Yes, I believe that former experience also helps me connect with folks all across my district. So it's funny because my great-grandpa Reingans was actually the Presbyterian minister in the Brooklyn Presbyterian Church, which is part of my district, and he and his wife are buried in the Brooklyn Cemetery. So it's honestly come by representing this district. It was 100 years ago in 1924 that my grandpa was the minister there. So I grew up in a small town, and my husband jokes, he likes to say that I speak fluent Republican, which is true, I do. And I understand where folks are coming from in rural areas. And I would say, and you've probably heard this from a lot of folks, issues that people are top of mind in rural areas are the same issues that are top of mind in more urban and suburban areas. It truly is not surprising that people are most worried about housing, about the cost of living, about making sure that they have health care and accessibility to health care. These are things that people are worried about in both urban and rural areas.
I've been talking to some activists in different parts of Michigan, especially rural Michigan, and also some who just want to run for their city government and county government. And I've asked them similar questions, so I'm going to ask you the same. What do you think Democrats or progressives can do better to reach out to rural voters? You know, the data has shown, of course, over the last few presidential elections, at least, but many elections, that Democrats have not been doing as well in rural areas. What do you think Democrats can do to reach out to those voters a bit more?
Well, I do think it helps for us to show up and to be involved and to make sure that we're listening to folks. I think a lot of rural voters feel a cultural identity in Republican politicians more than they necessarily think through all of the issues that might be facing them. A township supervisor or a county clerk, they have a specific role at a specific level of government. And I think it varies across the state. And people don't necessarily think of the role of their village government or their township government in its role in fixing roads or whatever, as far as when they're thinking of who to vote for. I think it's more of like a cultural feeling of feeling more aligned with Republicans overall. Most voters do think of what happens at the top of the ticket in DC as what their politicians are representing on the local level. So it is interesting to talk to folks and say, well, you know, like your township supervisor really only focuses on a very small, specific amount of things. They're not the one that really makes gun laws or decides what is taught in school. So it's an interesting juxtaposition to talk to folks in rural areas and have them tell me what they're really focused on. And sometimes their local electeds are not really going to be the ones to address those items.
You brought up something that others have brought up too, though. The first thing you said, Representative, was showing up. And I think maybe that's where some Democrats for many years have fallen short, is that there are many times in rural districts, people don't even have that option to vote for a Democratic candidate. So just showing up sometimes and letting people know, hey, look, we're out here, we're listening, we want to help you. That's a major, major starting point.
For sure it is. I will say, 2 years ago, ahead of my primary, I ended up catching COVID and had to convert from knocking doors face-to-face to doing phone calls. And I made hundreds of phone calls to people in the rural Jackson part of my district. And a lot of people answered and said, oh my gosh, I didn't even know there were any Democrats out here. I thought I was the only one. It's been really important for me to make sure I'm in my rural parts of my district, along with Senator Schenck, who also represents a lot of the same rural parts of my Washtenaw and Jackson district. And we really try to make sure that all the township supervisors have our phone number. We go meet with them. I've met with the Jackson County Sheriff and clerk and prosecutor just to make sure that I know them and they know me. And I think it really helps. I've definitely heard from some of our rural township folks, especially in Jackson County, that they're actually feeling very represented. Even though they disagree with me on many policy items, they feel like if they had a question, they could contact us. And they have. And we've been able to help them secure funding and address policy issues. And I think they're pretty pleased with feeling like they're involved and we're involved with their communities, too.
State Representative Kerry Reingans is my guest here on Left of Lansing this week. I saw a video that you posted back in 2022, saw it on YouTube when you were running for the State House, and you said something interesting when describing your campaign priorities. You brought up infrastructure, and you said something that, you know, in addition to, of course, when we think infrastructure, roads and sidewalks and internet access, all very, very important, of course. You said that infrastructure also meant health, behavioral health, elder care, and child care. And I thought that was an effective way to say that infrastructure includes those aspects as well as the physical infrastructure needs. What kind of work do you think has to be done to get everyone in the state and across the country, for that matter, to get into this mindset that infrastructure is more than just the physical things like roads and sidewalks?
Yeah, so I think this isn't just my own thoughts and talking points. I think the Biden administration really was embracing this early on and is trying to figure out ways to help push this idea across the whole country. This care infrastructure is really important because, you know, we as workers can't do our work if we don't have the internet and the roads to get to work, right? But we also need to make sure that our loved ones are cared for and our workers are healthy and cared for. So how do we make sure that we, you know, have the appropriate amount of elder care, the appropriate amount of child care? How do we make sure that if we are injured at work or if we are sick, that we can get the care we need to help our injury or sickness, or also help us if we are trying to get just up to speed on a regular everyday basis with our health as far as mental health goes? So I think it's very important to think of these because we can't have a healthy, thriving economy if we don't have healthy people. And the way to get healthy people is to make sure we're all cared for while we're working or while we are sick.
Representative Ryan Ganz, you mentioned in that YouTube video that I just brought up, you talked about how so many parts of our state's economy suffered through disinvestment, especially here in Michigan. So what would you say to some voters out there who would say, yeah, hey, look, I agree with you, we've got to invest more, but what exactly have state Democrats done with their power to reverse those trends? What would you say to them?
Well, one thing that we have done is repealed the retirement tax. So that is helping some seniors in and of themselves. We also have increased the working families tax credit, which helps families with children who are under certain income thresholds in order to retain some money in their pockets. In addition, we're also expanding pre-K, and we've been doing that through our budget process, as well as really working hard to partner with employers to make sure that they're participating in certain childcare programs at the state. We also have funded some organizations that help home-based childcare to expand and grow. It's, you know, it's a business that somebody has to set up and set up all the right business protocols. And so having help with consulting for that, I think, is something that we've been working on for the last couple of years. So I think we're doing little by little, and we've been hearing from our constituents. And, you know, I'm a parent. I was just talking earlier about dropping my child off at summer camp so that I could be out working today. We do need to make sure that we have enough parents of younger kids in the legislature so we really can relate to our constituents. This is a huge issue facing our community. Childcare is very expensive, and it still doesn't even pay the workers as much as they really deserve. So I think there's a whole structure here that we need to examine to make sure that there is sufficient childcare. And I think that Democrats in our trifecta are really looking at this, trying to figure out how do we fund this appropriately, and how do we make sure that the right technical support is there and the right business support is there to help expand this industry really across our state.
You know, I recently spoke with Danielle Atkinson from Mothering Justice, and
yes,
they're part of this coalition demanding that paid family leave bills, which have been sitting in the state legislature for a year, that they get some action. This would help so many working families who have to care for a sick relative or have to even care just for themselves, as you well know. So I know that's an effort that you support. Do you expect something? Are you hopeful to see something maybe happen on those bills when everybody gets back, maybe sometime in the fall?
I don't actually know the plans for those bills. I know that I do support them. And when I've been working with partners in both chambers of the legislature, there's a lot of complicated issues to figure out here, trying to really right size the requirements of those paid family leave laws to make sure that there's a certain size of business that has this requirement and that there's certain funding available for businesses to make sure that they can help afford to pay their workers if they are staying home. So I know that we're really trying to get this right as we are working through those bills. And I'm hopeful that we'll see some movement in the fall. And if we don't, that is just another reason to make sure that we work our butts off to keep this Democratic trifecta in effect going into next term. And as you are well aware, only the House is up for election this year. The Senate's not and the governor's not. So we're really where we need to keep our focus so that we can keep our majority in order to make sure that anything we aren't able to finish this term, that we really get a chance next term.
I'm going to ask you more about that as we wrap up here on the election coming up and, of course, why it's so vital to make sure that the House, the state House, remains blue. I just want to, since I've got you on here, I know that housing is important to you. You know, you've been highlighting the high cost of housing and renting in the state. Michigan is one of the few states, I think, without a cap on the price of renting a home, and with prices raising by the day, that's a hardship for many who are just trying to get by on a day-to-day basis. But you are part of an effort, Representative, to help alleviate that hardship in a few ways. And I was just wondering, since I've got you here, can you talk more about that?
Yes. Housing obviously is a basic need of life, and we all need somewhere to live. There aren't a ton of states that have caps on rent, but I would like Michigan to be one of them where it is allowed. And right now, the state law preempts local municipalities from setting any sort of caps. And I do think it would be great to repeal that law in order for those municipalities to decide what would work best for them. I live in the city limits of Ann Arbor right now, so our city council has passed a resolution calling for the repeal of that ban on local municipalities deciding their own stabilization policies for rent. So I think it would be a difficult kind of local ordinance to figure out what would work in each kind of municipality. But I think there are cities, Detroit's more than half renters, Ann Arbor's more than half renters. Cities like these really do want this flexibility to decide for themselves what would be appropriate for the residents of our own cities. So I do think that it would be great if we had that capability to decide, you know, our own fate within our own city limits. And it wouldn't be necessary everywhere. So I wouldn't want to make a statewide law that requires some sort of capping, because different communities would require different kinds of solutions.
If you had your way and could just wave a magic wand to help fix housing prices all across, not just your district, but across the state, what steps would you like to see get done?
Well, I think that in the kind of longer term, we need more housing of all types across different parts of our state. We also need to make sure that there's a little bit of regulation on short-term rentals. I mean, here in Ann Arbor, we're a tourist destination for 7 football Saturdays every year, right? So some people can make enough on renting their house out for 7 football Saturdays to pay their mortgage for the year. That housing sits empty the entire rest of the year. That is housing that families like mine could live in. But nope, they make more money doing that. And so it's a little bit of a weird incentive structure, right? So I think we need to regulate short-term rentals in a different way. I think we need to do some zoning changes across the state. Like in Minnesota, there's some higher density housing zoning by right, which would allow for the development and building of higher density homes for people all across the state. I think we need that here. In the short term, I do think allowing municipalities to put caps on rent increases would really help with the people who are currently living in rental properties. And then I do think we need to figure out a way to have better social kind of capital and public capital for the development of lower income housing. Right now, the incentive structure doesn't make a lot of sense for developers who are trying to get only private capital to do their development. You know, they have to make sure that they make enough money to keep developing, or else it doesn't make sense for them. They're not going to be developing housing in order to lose money when people are renting below market rate. So we do need to make sure that there's public financing available. And I'm proud that the legislature has created the first ever affordable housing fund. And it's ongoing funding from the corporate income tax. And I know there's a push to expand that and make it a larger amount of money. Instead of $50 million a year, $100 million a year is what a lot of folks are talking about, trying to make sure we make that change to allow funding for more social housing and more lower income housing.
Is that something that you really could support, increasing that to $100 million, as you just said?
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Okay. I know I've just got you for a few more moments. If you don't mind, I'd like to switch to a topic that I've been talking about here a lot. And whenever I bring it up on social media, it sparks all kinds of conversation. And that's the National Popular Vote Compact. It's something that you've been advocating for quite some time. And there's actually been some new developments here in Michigan when it comes to those bills that you've introduced. But first, before we get to that, can you just explain in your words what the compact is all about and why you believe that it's important for Michigan to join?
Yes, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is a compact between states who all agree that we should be awarding our electoral college votes based on who wins the national popular vote. And this is based on the principle that every one of us has an equal vote across the whole country. And so instead of just electing the president with the battleground states of America, we really should be electing the president using the entire United States of America. You know, the president's district is the whole entire country. And I think the president should have to win the most popular votes in their district in order to be elected. That's what I had to do. I had to win the most popular votes in my district in order to be elected. So I think the presidency should be no different. We're very fortunate in our country that the United States Constitution gives the power to state legislatures to determine how to award our electoral college votes. So I would like to make sure that our electoral college aligns with the national will of the people and that we elect our president using the national popular vote.
You brought up a great point, because the thing is, we utilize democracy when voting for state house seats or Senate seats or U.S. House and Senate seats. I mean, city council, school boards, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't do that to elect presidents. And that's just not democratic at all.
The founding fathers, as they were trying to figure out how to do the election of the president, they were trying to figure out how to make it somewhat fair, but somewhat logical. And I don't know how they ended up landing on the Electoral College as the logical way to do this. Since elections are administered by states and we had different states, they figured that each state could figure it out for themselves. And I think that we should use that logic of each state adding up our popular votes and then adding them up nationally across the country to see who has won the most popular votes. I mean, this is really important. You'll know that of the Supreme Court justices that are on the Supreme Court right now, a majority of them were appointed by presidents who didn't even win the national popular vote. So the Supreme Court was appointed by people who weren't even aligned with the national will. And we've seen Supreme Court decisions that are not aligned with the national will as a result. So this isn't just about the presidency. This is about the Supreme Court protecting our basic freedoms and making sure that these institutions and even our three branches of government align with the will of the people.
How many states have joined? 17? Is that correct?
Something like that. There's 209 votes committed of the 270 that we need. I'm hoping to add Michigan's 15 to that so that we can get even closer to the 270 that we need.
Well, I'd said that there were some new developments that happened here recently. Is it possible these bills will actually get a vote on the House floor by the election, let's say?
My goal is for us to have a vote on the House floor before the election, and I'm working on that and staying on top of, you know, being persistent about asking about that. So I do hope that we'll have a vote before the election. It would be nice to have it go through both chambers before the election. I do think that doing this in lame duck is going to look like we're responding to the presidential election this year. And I'd really like us to get this off our plates before that so that it is not looking as if we're just responding to an election.
That's a great point. Great point. And finally, speaking of elections, Democrats have a slim majority, of course, in the state house. And while the election, of course, is pivotal in terms of national politics, it's especially important for millions in the state who are working hard to keep the state house blue for the next 2 years. We know that there's some big money being raised by Republicans, such as former Governor Rick Snyder, who wants, you know, the out-of-touch extreme right-wing MAGA Republicans to get the House gavel. And I think that's in part because he's tired of seeing what Democrats have been doing here to erase his so-called legacy by passing some common sense legislation. But what will you say to your constituents while campaigning this fall on why it is so essential that Democrats retain control of the House and thereby the state trifecta?
Well, we've made a lot of great progress this term. And if we want to keep that progress going, we need to maintain this trifecta. Things like school lunches and school meals for kids in public schools, that only was possible for the first time through a Democratic trifecta. If we want to keep that going, we need to make sure that we have a trifecta going forward. And if we want to keep pushing for common sense safety, gun safety regulations, if we want to keep making sure that our elections are secure and voting rights are expanded to every corner of the state, we need to make sure that the Democrats maintain our trifecta. And if we want to protect our other basic freedoms, like our reproductive freedoms, we codified and passed other laws that help support abortion access, But in addition to that, we've also passed laws improving our surrogacy process in Michigan. We've also passed laws to protect in vitro fertilization in Michigan. And these are things that are under attack across the country, not to mention prescriptions such as contraception and other birth-related reproductive health issues are things that we've really worked hard to protect in Michigan. And I think we don't want to go backwards on any of those, especially since things seem to be going backwards a little bit at some other states.
That is true. Democratic State Representative Carrie Reingans from Ann Arbor. If people would like to find more information about you, or, you know, if they'd like to donate to your campaign or help you out, what should they do?
Well, you can find my official website for being a representative at repreingans.com. That's repreingans.com. And if you'd like to look at more campaign side items, you can go to carryreingans.com and you'll find links to donate. If you're in my district, you can request a yard sign and you can help volunteer my campaign team. We are recruiting folks to go with us to help defend and flip some of our fellow House seats, especially Southeast Michigan, but we'll be traveling all over the state this summer.
Outstanding. Representative Reingans, thanks so much for coming back on, and thanks for bringing common sense solutions to the table to help the common good. You are one of the reasons that Michigan is, in my opinion, making a turnaround here, and we need people like you in Lansing fighting for the health and economic freedoms for all Michiganders. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
He spent nearly 25 years working as a liberal voice in conservative talk radio across the state, and he's still a somewhat stable person. It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. You can find archives of the podcast, plus Pat's musings on other topics in written form at leftoflansing.com. Left of Lansing archives are available wherever you get your podcasts. And now Left of Lansing is available on YouTube. We'd like to thank Audioboom for distributing all our episodes so we can share progressive, otherwise known as common sense, values across Michigan and the country. Now, here's Pat Johnston.
You know, Representative Reingans mentioned something Democrats also passed, and I forgot to mention it in the opening segment, and that's common sense gun safety laws like safe storage, expanded background checks, and red flag laws. Speaking of which, the Detroit News had a story about Michigan's new red flag law this week, and it says at least 114 extreme risk protection orders have been used to remove the firearms of individuals believed to be a risk to themselves or others since the state's red flag law went into effect last winter, according to data by the Detroit News. And the news says that a vast majority of those were requested by law enforcement. So you see, we were kind of right when we said that police would like having this tool at their disposal. It's about saving lives. And that's what police are trained to do. But of course, when it comes to the gun violence epidemic in the country, more must be done. Over the holiday weekend, Michigan suffered its worst mass shooting in history when two people were gunned down and 19 others were injured during a block party on Detroit's east side. So far, no arrests have been made. So, yes, congratulate Democrats for getting something done after the school shootings that we experienced in the state, but realize there's more to do when it comes to gun violence in Michigan and across the United States. Here's this week's Left of Lansing Last Call. So this week I visited my neighborhood Rite Aid pharmacy for the last time before it closed down. We've been a customer there for at least, oh, I don't know, 2+ decades, and the pharmacist and workers there did so much for us. I mean, I just had to pull up to the drive-through window. They saw me, they knew who I was, and they just bring my prescriptions to the window without even having to ask me my name. They helped give me my flu shots and COVID shots and boosters. They were there for the community. They did good work. But every Rite Aid store in Michigan is now closing. So when I went to pick up my last prescription there this past Monday, I apologized to the worker who waited on me. And she appreciated that. She did. But she was visibly sad. And she said that others in her family were experiencing the same thing in other areas across the state. She and her fellow co-workers are now out of a job. They're out of a job by now. As many of you know, Rite Aid closed up all of its Michigan stores and a chunk of stores in Ohio. Customers are having their medications and records shipped to Walgreens, or if you live where I do, where the Walgreens across the street is also closed down, everything is being shipped to Meijer. Rite Aid filed for bankruptcy last year, and as the Detroit Free Press reports, that's due to declining sales, mounting debt, and a lawsuit that it may have contributed to the nation's opioid crisis. But there's actually more to it than that. As the Ohio Capital Newsroom reports in a big story this week, Rite Aid also suffered from pharmacy middlemen known as pharmacy benefit managers, or otherwise known as PBMs. The Federal Trade Commission unveiled a preliminary report this week describing how these large PBM middlemen, which include CVS Caremark, Express Scripts, and Optum Rx, is part of a much larger corporation that also owns a top 10 health insurer. They also own pharmacies, doctor's offices, and other links in the healthcare chain. And the report says that these three big PBMs, they get to decide which drugs are covered. They get to create pharmacy networks, and through this opaque system, they decide how much to reimburse pharmacies for the drugs they dispense. I mean, isn't that wonderful? Sounds like a wonderful, wonderful system. What could go wrong? The three biggest PBMs together are handling nearly 80% of prescription drug transactions on behalf of insured Americans, the FTC report said, and the largest six PBMs manage nearly 95% of all such prescriptions in the U.S. Everyone, this is driving out competition in the market, which of course leads to higher prescription costs for all of us. And here's another scary part of the report. It says all three of the biggest PBMs operate mail order pharmacies for expensive specialty drugs such as cancer medication. And they often encourage, if not require, patients to get their medication from them. That has resulted in PBM-affiliated specialty pharmacies controlling some 70% of sales in that class of drugs. Wow, I mean, the system isn't working, everyone. And it's driving out competition as these PBMs offer higher reimbursement rates to their pharmacies, while non-affiliated pharmacies have to pay higher costs. We're witnessing how that's hurting my rural town and also rural towns across the country, as 10% of pharmacies in rural areas closed in the past decade. I mean, this is not how capitalism is supposed to work, at least I didn't think so. Representative Ryan Gans last year proposed a bill that helps protect people who use copay assistant funds to pay for their medicine. You see, insurance companies and these PBMs are using some tricky math. Wasn't that what George W. Bush once said? Tricky math to stop patients from using their copay assistance funds towards their deductible, which ends up costing patients even more, which is exactly what these PBMs want. Representative Ryan Gans' bill, I don't believe, has passed yet. And I'm hoping after all of these pharmacy closures across the state due to greed, that Democrats will get cracking on it when they return this fall. Again, it's a no-brainer, and it will help some people at least, especially those who desperately, desperately need it. And see, people like Representative Ryan Gans are doing their best to try to help people. Wait. You think MAGA Republicans are going to do anything about this if they get into power? You know better.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan. It's Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Special thanks again to State Representative Carrie Reingans for coming back on this week. Representative, you always, always make every episode better when you're on it, so thank you so much. Next week, Jody Decker, who is a Democratic candidate for the 107th House District, will join me. Now, she's running to maybe face off against your favorite MAGA Republican state representative and mine, Neil Friske, who, for whatever reason, is yet to face charges after getting arrested last month for possibly and allegedly chasing an adult dancer around with a gun. That's who's representing that district, which includes Charlevoix. But while that's happening, Jody Decker is running to bring back some sanity and some common sense, because she, like many of us, want to just help people and help people, especially in her district. So she's my guest next week. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to me on YouTube as well. Listen, subscriptions really, really help out, and it helps me get the message out to as many progressives and progressive-minded people out there, especially across Michigan and across the nation. So thanks again for listening. Let's see what happens next week, and let's see what next week will bring us. Until then, remember, stay on offense and take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston. Written by Pat Johnston. Researched by Pat Johnston. Edited by Pat Johnston. And hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.